You want others to be informed. Subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 and Adventures in Waste. Executive producer Jack Eye, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Wake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is hosting a two-hour live panel discussion today, Earth Day, and we'll be airing it 2 to 4 in the afternoon. Our panel is titled State of Oregon's Environment 2024. KBOO is organizing the event and the panelists. We'll have five speakers from different environmental issue disciplines. Each panelist will speak to their work and then be available for a Q&A session by phone with our KBOO audience. Again, today, 2 to 4 p.m., tune in for our live panel, State of Oregon's Environment 2024. Our airroom phone lines will be open by the end of the panel, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, and KBOO's spring membership drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at kboo.fm/give between now and May 25th and support Avant-Garde Airwaves.
Support for Earth Day programming comes from KBOO members in One Green World, a family-owned nursery and garden center located in Southeast Portland, providing fruiting trees and shrubs, berries, vines, unique citrus, nut trees, vegetables, and much more to people all over the United States. Information at www.onegreenworld.com.
I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and on today's show, we hear about defending and replanting forests and about organizing against genocide, which is also ecocide. Today is Earth Day. I mean, pretty much every day might be Earth Day on KBOO Public Affairs shows. Special shout out here to the indispensable Locus Focus, Mondays at 10, right after the Old Mole Variety Hour. But you can often find Earth-friendly radio on Keeping It Real, Thursdays at 8 a.m., Wednesday Talk Radio at 8 a.m., and on That Vegan Show, and Voices for the Animals, and The Evening News, and more, because, well, it's KBOO. You can be part of this alternative to mainstream climate denial and greenwashing by becoming a member of KBOO, renewing your membership, or becoming a monthly sustaining member. Go to kboo.fm/give, or text KBOO to 44321. This is KBOO's Spring Membership Drive, focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and the alternative. So please help us reach our fundraising goal of $60,000. On today's Old Mole, we'll hear Sophie Smith in conversation with Karen Coulter, director of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, about forest defense on national forests east of the Cascades. We'll hear selections from eco-poet C. Marie Furman's talk last year at the Washington State University Visiting Writers Series about the hopefulness of obliterating dams and replanting forest on the South Fork of the Salmon River. And we'll hear Kevin Foster talking with Zia Leboff, an organizer with Jewish Voice for Peace Portland, on the sometimes challenging process of coming to organizing, about the role of Jewish people in the Palestinian rights movement, and about recent local actions. That conversation is quite relevant for Earth Day because the genocide in Palestine is also an ecocide. Militaries cause at least 5.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions annually, more than aviation and shipping industries combined. And military actions kill animals as well as people, pollute water resources, destroy agriculture and forests, and poison soil. But even beyond the usual environmental destruction of war, the scale of the damage in Palestine is extreme. Just the first 2 months of Israel's assault on Gaza generated more planet-warming emissions than the annual carbon footprint of more than 20 of the world's most climate-vulnerable nations. And the targeted destruction of Gazan farms, greenhouses, and aquifers have led to renewed calls to make ecocide an international crime. And of course, organizing to end the violence in Palestine is also relevant for Earth Day because all our struggles are connected here on our only planet, and lessons for organizers can transfer across issues and campaigns. Some of the music on today's episode comes from climatemusic.org. We'll hear clips of Eric Ian Walker's composition Climate, in which data measuring the history of Earth's climate shapes what we hear. Carbon dioxide concentration is reflected in the tempo. Atmospheric temperature is represented by pitch, and Earth energy balance is audible as distortion. This is avant-garde music for the Earth, from the Earth. As ever, you'll be able to find the podcast of this episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour and its segments on the KBOO app or on our website at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour, where you can also find a link to subscribe to our show and to contact us and to support your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered, nonprofit community radio station by clicking on the red Donate tab. We turn now to Kevin Foster talking with Zia Leboff, an organizer with Jewish Voice for Peace Portland.
Hello, KBOO listeners. I'm super excited to have Zia Leboff on the Old Mole Variety Hour today. Welcome to KBOO, Zia.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Zia has been an activist for a number of years, but specifically got involved in organizing through her time at Portland State University with the PSU Student Union. She is Jewish and has helped organize a number of actions through the Portland chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, also known as JVP, to pressure local officials to call for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. So, Zia, could you tell me a bit about where your organizing for Palestine really began?
Yeah, I started organizing around the summer of 2018, and it was with someone who I met through the Portland State Student Union and was just kind of, hey, I'm looking for other anti-Zionist Jews to get a chapter of JVP started at PSU campus to just create more of space for Jews who are not down with Israel, which there are quite a good many of us. And in that moment, it was really just like the perfect timing in my life for many reasons of like having had some dealings with Zionist family that had come to a head. And like, so it felt like a very aligned moment. And I was like, yeah, I'm down. and specifically my past experience of being at PSU involved my freshman year with the Jewish Student Union, and feeling as soon as I started to question and critique Zionism, feeling that was a space that wasn't welcoming to me anymore. And so really having come full circle from my freshman year to now that's my senior year, being like, wow, okay, this is the moment. And I learned so much through that process of doing my first work with JVP. And in many ways, I see JVP as one of my first organizing homes, because it was one of the first places that I helped create kind of a structure and a space for and tried to bring other people into. So I just have so much appreciation for JVP and so much appreciation for how that work with JVP put me in community with so many incredible like Palestinians, Jews, and other allies, accomplices for Palestine.
So one of the things that we've seen recently after October 7th is last fall, the PSU students, they began organizing against Boeing again. Could you tell me a little bit about your experience at PSU in a similar campaign where Boeing was the target and why they were the target?
Yeah. So when I was at PSU in 2016, there was a very controversial, I guess is the word, resolution that came through the PSU student government. And at that moment in time, I was very involved with ASPSU, Associated Students of Portland State University. I was a senator, and then started in spring of 2016 and continued into the fall of 2016, where it was actually voted on. That resolution was actually not as focused on Boeing. It was focused on calling for PSU to sever connections with any organizations that profit from human rights violations against Palestinians. And like, I believe the main four companies that were being called out in that resolution were actually Caterpillar, Motorola, HP, and G4S. So those were the main four, but Boeing absolutely falls in line with the same thing of like companies involved with Israeli military occupation. And so I think I'm really glad that that resolution is being used as a little bit of precedent for the really impactful work that Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights at PSU is doing now, because I think it's really important to highlight the ways that the spaces that we occupy have complicity, especially by working with these very complicit companies, because I believe PSU is, they have a program that feeds into Boeing, like a PSU supply chain for Boeing. And I think that is really just the opposite of, PSU likes to talk about having so much progressive values, but in actuality, is very complicit with many structures of oppression, as we've seen from their armament of campus police and who they want to do business with and just who is on their board of trustees. This is kind of the theme for my entire 4 years at PSU. But I think that, yeah, I just really want to uplift and encourage people to go support and read more about the campaign that they're pushing forward, and also read more about the ways that right now PSU is trying to publicly condemn them and is trying to put a lot of restrictions on their organizing and discipline students of color who are speaking out and in really unjust ways. So I know that they have a petition going around right now to speak out and encouraging all alumni of PSU to do so, as well as just community members in general, because PSU loves to talk about how it's, forget what the slogan is, led by the community for the community, but that doesn't always show up in the action. So I think it's really important for the larger Portland community to show up and support these students who are doing really important work and continuing work that's been happening through Super for many years now.
Well, it seems like that repression could be really dangerous, especially considering, like we've discussed a bit about the effect of being involved in these campaigns had on you. And you discussed a little bit about how hearing public testimony from the other side of like non-Zion or anti-Zionist groups was really important. Could you elaborate just a little bit on like what that effect was?
I really see it as one of the turning points in my education around this issue, because before I came to PSU, I was definitely someone who was not raised in a, like my father is not a Zionist, and I wouldn't call my grandparents either, who were my strongest Jewish influences in my life, but my extended family is. And so they kind of domineered holidays. And when I came to PSU, I definitely had some like healthy criticisms of Israel already, but not fully educated on everything. And moving to a city where I didn't know anyone, one of the first places I was brought into community through one person I met was the Jewish Student Union. And I was like, wow, what an incredible community space. I'm like on my own for the first time, kind of adrift. And like, you're all these people who are so welcoming, you know, I'm getting taken to these really nice dinners and I'm getting taken to these organizing retreats on the Oregon coast. And wow, it feels so community. And then slowly I started to realize all these people who are leadership of the Jewish Student Union are also now starting this group called the Cultural Historical Association for Israel. I don't know about that, but because that was the community space I have, I felt, I think there was a lot of ways that I was very much just overtaken by the Zionism of the space and like how that was so well woven into Judaism. And I was just like, wow, I feel like so connected to community. So I was kind of blinded in many ways to the harm. And it wasn't until that's fall era, winter era, and then spring of that year was when the divestment resolution took place and or started. And I just seeing the reaction, like that was my first time being in student government, seeing the reaction of some of these Jewish student leaders who were also in the pro-Israel group was so intense. The amount of background work they were doing of trying to see all of these different people on student government and how they were going to vote. I was like, whoa, this feels like some very intense level politics for student government at a public university. And then they were really pressuring me to vote against the resolution, of course. And at first I was kind of like, oh, okay, well, like I'm hearing all these things of why you think that and I care about you and you're like my closest friend, like of course. And then it wasn't until the process, as a backstory, like no one came to student government meetings. No one really was showing up to give public comment at all. And then for those divestment resolution meetings, 2 hours of public comment each time. And it would go back and forth. Like there was a list of people who were signed up pro and a list of people who were signed up against. And the way they had it was literally like back and forth. And I think that that was really powerful because seeing the thought, the justification, the argument put back to back like that was so overwhelmingly obvious that it was essential to be doing divestment work and that it was very much in line with all of my other values to be doing divestment work. And it really like cracked the shell of Zionism that had been put on me through this Jewish community. And I was like, wait, I don't think I can vote against this, guys. Like, I think that this is actually really in line and important work to be doing. And as soon as I started to critique that, I felt very unwelcomed in that space anymore. And I've heard similar things from other people that I've connected with who I met through that time and started to, and I was like, why did you drop off? Did you drop off because you were discouraged from saying anything that critiqued Israel? And they were like, yeah. And so we've had a couple of moments of that. And so I think that public testimony is a really powerful vessel for bringing forth a lot of understanding and education. And so I think when, you know, if universities are trying to quell that, it's definitely a very dangerous practice because that is one of the most true like instances of a public forum that I've ever seen and been a part of. And it had a very foundational impact for me. And I think that that's something that people have to see in general with how Zionism works is that Zionism has so thoroughly stolen from and weaponized Judaism that it's really hard for many to start to do that unlearning process if their whole community is still in that belief. Like it was a challenging thing. Like I lost my strongest place of community that I had found on PSU campus and kind of had to do some rebuilding. But luckily I was involved with student government where I got to meet some really incredible people that went through that same process with me. And I rebuilt my community with people whose values were aligned with mine and also helped further educate me and teach me more. And so I think that it's hard for people to understand how that unlearning process goes. But I think when I've talked to other anti-Zionist Jews, for so many of us, it's very different things that help that dispelling all of these really, really firmly entrenched Zionist propaganda. Like I always say, all US citizens receive a ton of propaganda to be pro-Israel, and US Jews receive like triple the amount. It's just in every space. It's in many, many Jewish communities and many, many like institutions. And so it takes a lot of work and it's a hard unlearning process, but it's so important because it's how we find the true values of Judaism, because the true values of Judaism are so far from Zionism. I think they're in direct opposition personally.
Your experience just reminds me so much of the movie Israelism, which we've talked about on KBOO before. And it's a really great depiction of just what it's like trying to escape that veil of Zionism and how it can be like one thing that really changes that for people, but you're not necessarily searching that out. In that context, how do you feel about the role that you play as a Jewish person in the movement for a free Palestine?
The way that I've shortly summed it up is I think the role right now for anti-Zionist Jews is both organizing Jews and organizing as Jews. And those are two separate but very intrinsically tied work. And I think organizing as Jews is showing up in solidarity with the Palestinian leadership. It's very infuriating to me that people can't just hear it from Palestinians, that it's not anti-Semitic to be critiquing Israel, that it's not anti-Semitic to look at this state that is clearly militarized and enacting apartheid and enacting all these systems of oppression and just understand why that needs to be critiqued. It's very infuriating. And there's a lot of undertones of Islamophobia and racism for why people can't just hear that from Palestinians. But I do think that is our part of our role as anti-Zionist Jews to show up and amplify the demands of Palestinians, to be like, these demands are not anti-Semitic. These demands are what it looks like to seek justice. And so I think that kind of said it, Zionism has absolutely weaponized anti-Semitism to condemn people from critiquing Israel's genocidal actions. And so I think part of our role is to publicly refute that and say, no, anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. And I think part of our role is also to provide the counter to a lot of Zionist entrenched Jewish organizations that are continuing to do the same thing of distracting from what's happening in the genocide that we are currently watching unfold, and kind of distracting with anti-Semitism, which is deeply infuriating because anti-Semitism is alive and well, and it's largely being perpetuated by the far right. That's the space that I have seen anti-Semitism in. I've never encountered anti-Semitism in pro-Palestine organizing spaces. And I think that Zionist institutions are trying to distract from Israel's atrocities by being like, no, look over here at anti-Semitism. And it's a tactic that's been used for decades. And so part of our work is showing up and saying, this is not anti-Semitism, like I was recurrently seeing with some local campaigns around the Portland public schools, where it's incredible the work that educators and students are doing to challenge Portland public schools to be more aligned with actual education and divestment and what their students are calling for. And then we're also seeing the Jewish Federation condemning that. And so I think it's important for us to be, you know, so many people look to that organization as the voice of Jews in Portland, and we know that they're not. We know that they are a voice, but they are in no way representative of larger Jewish community in Portland. From their own survey that they took last year, a majority of Jews in Portland do not identify as Zionist. And so it's really important for us to be able to show up in solidarity with the campaign demands of pro-Palestine organizations and being like, this is important. This is not anti-Semitism. Do not use that as a tactic to distract from the important work that they're trying to do.
And then could you tell me a bit about your recent successful actions with the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners and just with those critics, how you deal with certain disruptions as an organizer?
Yeah. So it's always interesting being in a space like that, where it's a public forum. Anyone can come, anyone can speak and give public comment at a Multnomah County board meeting. For me, the biggest wins of that was really around the community that was built and around the coalitions that were built doing that work. In a lot of ways, it was symbolic because obviously Multnomah County calling for a ceasefire is not going to immediately change the situation and conditions on the ground in Gaza. But I think it is important to add more local municipalities to the growing list to continually put pressure on our federal government and to show, especially in an election year, that there's so much of our population and of our voting constituents that want to see Israel held accountable for what's happening and are going to continue calling out the U.S. government for being complicit. It's a challenging piece because you know that local government resolution is never going to hold language that is up to the same par of politics that I would want to see. And I think the process of electoral politics is very challenging because you get worn down over time and just accept breadcrumbs. And so I am proud of the work that we did to continue pressuring for a resolution that didn't include Zionist talking points, like a two-state solution, like condemnations of Hamas. I think it's really important that that language wasn't in there, because I think as the largest local government in Oregon to put out a ceasefire resolution, that this one will be at the setting point for other resolutions in the area. So it was really important that that language wasn't in there. And overall, I think it's important that we find ways to mobilize locally and we think about the ways that we can have impact in our local communities, even around these international issues. That can be a really challenging piece. And so I think there'll be many more campaigns similarly brought forth by many organizations. But also, as we've been talking about with public testimony, I think that that was a really impactful part of it. And some of the commissioners spoke to that. It was to know how much it actually has an impact beyond what they say with their words, because they're politicians. But I think that we organized a lot of incredibly powerful voices to come forward and speak. And I'm so glad that those people did, because I think that that was, I hope that that had a similar impact as it did for me many years ago, of how it really was a radicalizing moment for me. And I think that based on the testimony and the impact that we saw in the crowd and on the commissioners, that showing up in such strong numbers and force as being pro-Palestine community in Portland had an impact. And I think especially when you compare it to the disruptive reactions, I don't know, I could count on my hand how many Zionist testimonies there were in comparison to the like dozens and dozens of powerful pro-Palestine testimony. And I think that's an important comparison that was made.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Zia. It was really great to hear about your experience as an organizer. And I'm sure people who are getting into this can take a lot from it. And I was just wondering, where should people look if they want to stay up to date on actions?
Thank you so much. It's really hard, I think. And there's so much apathy because people are overwhelmed to stay engaged, but it's so important now more than ever. And I think there's a lot of great ways to do so. There's so many incredible organizations doing work right now. I often direct people to the Instagram account PDX for a Free Palestine, four as the number four, because that account has been regularly updating every pro-Palestine event that is happening locally, and they'll shout out different organizations and then follow those organizations. I organize with JBB Portland, encourage people to follow there. Also, the Oregon to Palestine Coalition. Zaytuna is an incredible organization. Swana Rose. There's so many different spaces that people can keep engaged with, but all
lots
of those
of
get shouted out on the PDX for Free Palestine Instagram. So I often direct people there because I think it's a great resource and appreciate those folks trying to keep all of us engaged.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again for being on the show today, Zia. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
That was Some of the Composition Climate by Eric Ian Walker from climatemusic.org. And before that, Kevin Foster talking with Zia LaBeouf about her work organizing with Jewish Voice for Peace Portland. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michel. You can check on the KBOO webpage for today's show to find more information about all our segments, including an expanded version of Kevin and Zia's conversation, and links to more about the relation of genocide and ecocide. While you're there, you can click on the red Donate tab or go to kboo.fm/give to become a member. This is KBOO's Spring Membership Drive, focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and the alternative. Please help us reach our fundraising goal of $60,000. Later on today's show, we'll hear selections from eco-poet C. Marie Furman's talk last year at the Washington State University Visiting Writer Series about walking the forest on the South Fork of the Salmon River in Idaho. We turn now to Sophie Smith, talking with Karen Coulter, director of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, about defending forests.
Welcome to Field Notes, a recurring segment on the Old Mole Variety Hour that collects reports from on-the-ground social movements, past and present. I'm Sophie Smith. Today, we're heading into the national forest lands that lie to the east of the Cascades Range to look at a multi-decades grassroots effort to defend precious wild ecosystems against commercial logging and environmental degradation. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project has been working since 1991 to challenge timber sales, as well as road building, livestock grazing, herbicide and biocide use, and mining on federal lands in eastern Oregon and southeastern Washington. The work of forest defense is ever more vital as anthropogenic climate change radically alters our weather patterns, our ecosystems, and our communities, and the extraction industries and military-industrial complex that drives it continue to emit fossil fuels at a record pace. Forests, particularly mature and old growth, are what experts term natural climate solutions. However, at least 96% of all primary forests in the United States have been logged since the colonization of the continent, and the majority of those that remain are concentrated on federal lands that remain largely unprotected from expansive commercial logging operations. All told, logging causes 10 times the carbon emissions of wildfires, though it's almost never mentioned by federal environmental policymakers. What's more, logging has been shown to significantly increase the frequency, size, and scope of climate change-fueled forest fire. As we head into the summer in the Pacific Northwest, the concerted defense of these vital ecosystems is more important than ever. Today, I'll speak with Karen Coulter, director and co-founder of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, BMBP. Karen has been fighting to defend and restore forests on public lands in eastern Oregon for over 30 years. She's been surveying timber sales every summer since BMBP's inception to gather critical ecological information that's built countless successful legal cases that have stopped or significantly reduced logging and other environmental harms on these public lands. Karen's trained over 300 volunteers in forest ecology and activist skills, including me, and she gives regular workshops on everything from field survey work to fighting corporate rule. Karen's dedicated her life to environmental and social justice causes, and she's an incredible comrade, mentor, and dear friend. Welcome to Field Notes, Karen. I'm so happy to have the chance to speak with you about forest defense on this Earth Day.
Well, I'm very happy to be working with you, Sophie. You're a fabulous activist in person, too.
Well, I wanted to start by talking a little bit about climate change and large trees. As we all know, we're facing an unprecedented climate emergency that environmentalists have been sounding the alarm on for decades, including many people like you who are some of the first defenders of old growth forests here in the Pacific Northwest. Can you talk a little bit about the critical ecological role of ancient trees, ancient forests, in fighting climate change?
Well, the most important part about ancient forest is the size of the trees. When the trees become old growth, they tend to be much larger or very big, and large or big trees sequester and store the most carbon as a natural carbon sink. And the importance of this is that, for instance, James Hansen, the climate scientist, has noted that even if we stopped all our fossil fuel use, if we didn't preserve our carbon sinks, our natural carbon sinks of the oceans and the forests, we would still be pretty doomed, because we need to preserve those sinks in order for everything to balance and to reduce climate change. Old trees also maximize carbon sequestration and storage for up to centuries. From the time they're a live tree, and a live old growth tree could last for centuries, then they become a snag, which stores the carbon longer for decades. And then the snag becomes a log, if these trees are not logged, that stores carbon in the soils. So it's incredibly important to keep our forests preserved.
Right. And when a forest is cut, it's not just the carbon emissions from all that heavy equipment or building roads that causes those emissions in logging, but actually releases that carbon into the air at something like 10 to 15% is stored in timber products. And a lot of the industry response is, well, we replant, but trees have to get to about 80 years old before they're really that efficient in storing carbon. And so replanting just really can't keep up the pace. I always like saying that this is an ancient technology, right? A carbon sink form of carbon capture that requires no new invention. It just requires defense, protection, and allowing for growth.
The biggest source of carbon dioxide emissions in Oregon is commercial logging.
Given the importance of these vital forest ecosystems for our climate future, one would think that the Forest Service would be working very hard to protect ancient, old growth, mature forests from logging. However, as I found as a volunteer with Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project for the last 10 years, the Forest Service is actually consistently proposing and carrying out numerous commercial timber sales on public lands every single year, many of which aim to target large trees. Can you talk a little bit about the context of logging on public lands in Eastern Oregon? What kind of commercial timber sales are you seeing? What are some of the trends? And what is the role of the Forest Service as what we think of as the stewards of these vital habitats in pushing these sales through?
Well, when we first started field surveying proposed timber sales in Eastern Oregon in the early 1990s, the timber sales averaged about 2,000 to 6,000 acres of commercial logging, with what was then somewhat legitimately called commercial thinning, with some exceptions of clear cutting in the wetter Umatilla National Forest. However, the current Forest Service trend in Eastern Oregon is to commercially log up to 25,000 to 100,000 acres in one timber sale, with increasing logging intensity to the point of actual clear cutting, which they had abandoned in Eastern Oregon because it didn't regenerate well in the dry forest. And also, they're now on a logging rotation of returning to the past timber sale areas within 30 years or at about 30 years or less, which is completely unsustainable ecologically, culturally, and economically. Soils can have detrimental long-term soil impacts from logging of up to 40 to 70 years. So that's a very long time for these soils to be non-productive. In Germany, with silvicultural practices that are now used by the Forest Service, trees could no longer grow as large as they used to because of these practices of logging on short rotations in particular. When the national forests were first designated as such, they were called forest reserves, with the goal of protecting these forests from rampant, uncontrolled corporate logging at that time. The Forest Service doesn't really talk about that anymore. These national forests were indigenous people's lands, which indigenous people respected as part of their spiritual beliefs and cultural practices. Under Gifford Pinchot being in charge of the national forests, Pinchot changed forests conceptually to being crops that should be harvested on a regular basis, which is not how forests evolved or how they function as a natural ecosystem.
Many will kind of demonize the timber industry or point the finger there in terms of why is it that forests are being so heavily logged, but it's, I think, important to understand the really central role of the Forest Service in designing and proposing these commercial logging projects, many of which are kind of cloaked in this language of a commercial timber sale will be called a vegetation treatment or forest management or be a measure of fuel reduction. But then you look at it and it's virtually a clear cut, or even there's been projects I've surveyed that are called restoration projects that are commercial logging projects. And so they almost never say logging on their proposed timber sales. And it really is a disservice to the public in being able to understand what's happening and weigh in. But one of the advantages of the Forest Service being so involved is that it is a public agency, and we are supposed to have a voice in what they do. And that's definitely a big part of the BMP's specific strategy for defending the forest. So could you talk a little bit about how BMP goes about its work pursuing forest defense, what the point of intervention is with the Forest Service, and what some of the results have been?
Yeah, both of the co-founders of Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project came from backgrounds of direct action to protect the national forests. However, when we moved to Eastern Oregon, it was obvious that direct action was not going to be effective due to huge timber sales with multiple roads and a mostly very right-wing local public and long distances from media outlets and potential supporters. So instead, we learned from scratch how to legally defend the forest through field surveying, writing comments and objections to proposed timber sales, and determining which timber sales could be negotiated with the Forest Service and which sales had good claims and could be litigated. And I want to note that we had to start from scratch. We had to learn the science of the ecology of Eastern Oregon forests. We had to learn the environmental laws, and we'd borrow other groups' appeals. At that time, it was appeals rather than objections. And we would literally cut and paste. This was before widespread use of personal computers. And nonetheless, our organization continued to grow, and we have a fairly good track record of significantly modifying or stopping timber sales compared to other environmental organizations. I attribute our relative success to field surveying, which is the backbone of all our work, because it informs our comments and our objections through evidence from the ground, from field surveying, and maintains our passion to fight the sale, because we camp in the proposed timber sales from weeks to months to even recurrent summer seasons for the biggest sales. This way, we're not necessarily believing whatever the Forest Service says in their timber sale environmental assessments or environmental impact statements, as we're gathering evidence of the existing conditions. We are more passionate about doing everything we can to stop or modify a timber sale because we get to know the forest area, we see the wildlife, and we get attached to our vivid memories from living there and interacting with the plants, the forests, and the wild animals. We have community in the forest. Over the last 33 years, we've had hundreds of volunteers out in the forest and have stopped tens of thousands of acres of commercial logging and modified tens of thousands of acres more, often getting never logged areas dropped, steep slope logging dropped, riparian area logging dropped, and protection for old growth and large trees. We haven't kept records of exactly how much forest we've saved, but it's important to recognize that the Forest Service victories that we have are always temporary. In other words, we can win in court on a particular timber sale and stop it or significantly modify it, and they can just come back again to it and log more. So it's very important to realize that we need national policy changes.
Yeah, I think the work of Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is this really special kind of powerful combination of on-the-ground field work, spending time in threatened forests, and then also doing this work within the system, but not just simply working within the system in a pacified way, but suing the system or threatening legal action to force the system to shift or compromise on these given sales. So it's a really savvy approach that really combines these different points of intervention in a unique way. In terms of specific legal protections that BMBP has advanced for large trees, I wanted to talk for a moment about what's known as the 21-inch rule, which I was hoping you could explain the origins of the rule, what 21-inch DBH refers to, and some of the recent federal attempts to overturn it and the kind of provisional victory that we're seeing in terms of reinstating this protection for large trees.
We provided legal standing as plaintiffs for the Natural Resources Defense Council in 1995 for their threatened litigation over the Blue Mountains National Forest having outdated forest plans. The National Forest Management Act requires that forest plans be revised every 10 to 15 years. The outcome of NRDC's negotiations was to require a 21-inch diameter limit, and that's a diameter breast height, 4 feet, 6 inches high on the tree.
So anything less than 21 inches breast height was off limits, right?
Yeah. And the 21-inch limit was based on ponderosa pine generally being old growth or 150 years to be designated as old growth by that size, the 21 inches. And that's where that 21 inch figure came from. The 21 inch diameter limit and the riparian area protections that we got through those negotiations were arguably the most outstanding long-term accomplishments we've had, as they affected six national forests, limiting and stopping the rampant logging of large and old trees. During the COVID pandemic in 2021, the Region 6 of the Forest Service, which is in the Pacific Northwest, decided to ram through an amendment to eliminate the 21-inch limit that applied to all the Blue Mountains National Forests in eastern Oregon. They changed the legal enforceable standard of not logging above 21 inches diameter at breast height to a voluntary guideline that would inevitably result in wholesale logging of large trees on a landscape scale with virtually every timber sale. This is what's been proposed in almost every timber sale since this change. Inevitably, the barrage of large tree logging would also remove many old growth trees, contrary to the rhetoric about managing to retain old growth trees under this amendment. However, Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project challenged the amendment of the 21-inch cutting limit, quickly followed by a group of multiple organizations also challenging the decision. And so far, a magistrate and Judge Aiken have made good rulings, including the ruling to vacate the amendment itself, which should reinstate the 21-inch limit for logging by the Forest Service until at least the Forest Service appeals the decision or prepares an environmental impact statement.
BMBP's fieldwork relies really heavily on volunteers coming out every year to help survey every single area of a proposed timber sale, measure trees, profile the forest, document wildlife. So I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about what it is that volunteers do when they come out, what a typical day in the field looks like. And I'll mention a little bit about how to get involved in this year's field season, which is just around the corner. So do you need to be a trained ecologist to help BMBP defend the forest?
Not at all. I'm not a trained ecologist either, although I have a lot of naturalist experience over the years. But volunteers get trained by either me or an experienced volunteer, usually for at least 3 days. An ordinary day field surveying is we eat breakfast together and we figure out where we're going on the map and who's going out with whom. We hike through the proposed sale areas. We measure large trees and slope steepness and canopy closure and take notes and photographs to document wildlife signs, unusual plants, tree species composition and structure, steep slopes, stream conditions, scenic views, signs of recreational use, things like that. And we hike all day, but we're not hiking very fast. We're taking notes and photographs, which makes it more accessible for a lot of people. We eat lunch in the field or at the truck, and then we field survey in the afternoon, then return at least 2 hours before dark to have dinner together.
I want to say, as someone who's been going back every summer for about 10 years, it's really impactful to experience these forests directly. Sometimes it's like being in an incredibly wild place, untouched cathedral old growth forest that's under threat. Sometimes it's surveying an area that's already been deeply damaged by multiple logging cycles, and you're really seeing what that impact means. On the ground is this really undeniable immersive education in the meaning of forest management policy and in forest ecology with the incredible tutelage of Karen. So it's this really important opportunity. I think I really want to encourage anyone interested to pursue volunteering. You can find details about how to volunteer, how to get in touch with Karen via the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project website, bmbp.org. Again, the summer field season is coming up, so we're looking for volunteers. So as we close our program on Earth Day, I was hoping to ask you, Karen, if you have a favorite memory or two of field surveying wild places with BMBP that you'd like to share that stuck with you, an encounter with wildlife, a special place while you've been doing this work.
Yes, Earth Day is actually my birthday. I would love to claim responsibility for that, but I was 12 during the first Earth Day, but I was involved on the first Earth Day. A lot of my favorite memories from field surveying, there's been incredible numbers of special places, but a lot of the memories that are outstanding for me are the wildlife observations. For instance, Sophie and I both saw a wolf for the first time in eastern Oregon in the Ochoco, a big black wolf. It was amazing. And then I've seen martens twice in very fleeting glimpses. They're very fast. And a volunteer and I watched a Pacific fisher run right along a big old growth Douglas fir log right in front of us when they weren't even known to exist there in the Ochoco. However, even more special are my experiences with the way I've been able to relate to wildlife species. Once I saw a black bear clearly daydreaming as it walked straight towards me, towards my truck, actually, with its eyes wide open and didn't even see it until I clicked the camera and then it freaked out and noticed me. And then I also saw a coyote walking straight towards me and my dog when field surveying. And we were in pretty much plain sight, and it had its eyes open looking straight at us and didn't see us because it was daydreaming. So it's just lovely to realize that animals daydream and dream and think and have emotions and all of that.
Thank you so much, Karen Coulter, for joining us today. Again, everyone, please visit bmbp.org to learn about how to volunteer with the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project doing important forest defense work this summer. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Field Notes. This is Sophie Smith signing off for the wild.
That was a little of the song Witches by Blackbird Realm from their album Swidden. And before that, Sophie Smith talking with Karen Coulter, director of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, about forest defense and how to get involved in saving trees, forests, and planet. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. You can check out the Old Mole page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour to find more information about all of our segments. While you're there, you can click on the red donate tab or go to kboo.fm/give to become a member. This is KBOO's Spring Membership Drive, focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and the alternative. So please help us reach our fundraising goal of $60,000 so we can keep bringing you these alternatives to mainstream climate denial and climate despair. Our last segment today is from poet C. Marie Furman, who spoke last year at Washington State University. In her full talk, she describes the history and ecology of the South Fork of the Salmon River, the life cycle of salmon, the beauty of balsam root, the industry of logging, and much more. You can find audio of that entire talk on our show's webpage in a day or so, but we'll listen now to selections from the beginning of the talk and after a brief clip from Eric Ian Walker's Climate, selections from the very end. Here is C. Marie Furman.
This is a story about a South Fork Salmon River logging road and what it means to be a good ancestor. And this is the story of a river, a road, and a fish. The river is the South Fork of the Salmon. More specifically, it is the stretch of the South Fork of the Salmon River that begins in a meadow named Stoley until it joins the Seasash River beneath my favorite bridge. Bridge that curves in a way to suggest it is hugging the river, that curves like a comma, asking drivers to pause as they cross, to pause and look into the water below. Look in, as if there are answers there to our important questions. Look in, because there are answers there. To know the landscape of the South Fork of the Salmon River, hold your hands at heart level, palms down. Spread the fingers of one hand and then the other and weave them together, stopping at your first knuckle. Here is where the river winds through, still cutting the canyon that holds it. And there, between your fingers, are the drainages. And if you can imagine the landscape of your hands as big as mountains, like the Salmon River mountains that hold the South Fork of the Salmon River, you will see how steep your fingers have become. What a travail it may be to get to the back of your hand. Oh, but what a gift the summit will be when you get there. I look west and see what is called obliteration. Trees uprooted, earth upside down, soil tilled and mounded, rocks strewn without pattern, scrapes and pulls, and what could be called catastrophe. If I didn't know what Caleb then tells me, soon a woman toting a canvas bag filled with seeds, native seed mix, seeds of yarrow and bunch grass will come walking past. She will scatter the seed while others transplant ninebark and ceanothus into newly uncompacted soil that was only hours or days earlier road. She will walk east toward the river, where I can see the giant orange excavator working its way down and down the ridgeline, down the old road. The compacted bed it tears up as it moves, pulling together road cut to road fill, pulling hillside to hillside together like seams of a wound. On occasion, the excavator will grab a root ball and all of a juvenile pine and place it into a hole it's left in the wreck. Then a rock, then another swipe above to pull below, leaving slope where shelf once had been. And for a moment, It is like I am watching time unwind, history in reverse, 6 feet an hour. And the irony of the Indian trail meeting the road, the native seed planted in the uncompacted soil, the irony of healing a wound, or maybe what looks like the metaphor for the beginning of a healing between ancestors new and old, was not lost on me. And when the excavator reaches the river, it will be driven to the top of another nowhere going road, and it will begin again and again until another 300 miles of roads are obliterated. And then, after the woman with her seed, the workers with their shovels leave the first prints in this fresh but not new soil, the land will be left to heal. The sound of the heavy equipment that has brought destruction and grace will reside in the rings of the Ponderosa. The rain that has fallen, the rain that gave us pause and chill, the rain that fell as if it had a job to do, will soak into the soil that is the soul of all things in the South Fork of the Salmon River, will make its way to seed, to root, and it will feel something like I felt the first time I saw the South Fork, something like I felt when I saw the upturned earth, something like I hadn't imagined was possible, something like love, but more like hope. And the most hope in the story has to do with what this unroading will do for fish and the river, though that's important too. This hope I felt welling like pain beauty tears was hope for the humans who visit this land. Because in the plan that created this change, the forest plan, the plan of land managers, was a plan future thinking, a story written by those who will be seen as good ancestors, even as they will never live to see the result of their work. For though it will take a half century or more for the wound to heal, it will. And there's a chance that another woman a century after my passing, as in love as I am with the South Fork of the Salmon River, will, of a May morning, walk out, she guesses, is a game trail. She will follow the track of wolves and bear, the heart-shaped hoofprints of deer and the musk of elk. She will look into the eyes of the arrow leaf, and she will, not knowing all the ancestors looking back at her, she will, I hope, feel the ghosts of others that ask her to stop and look first and east. She will stop near the base of a lodgepole that may be then only a snag, a ghost itself, still stalwart and knowing, and she will lean against it and stare upon a landscape that she would never have imagined a road upon. She will step the edge of the ridge and look in and see what some have called resource, some have called preserve, some have called wilderness, and some have no name for it all except home. And maybe compelled by beauty and not the fear of losing it, she will step to the edge, arms open, head bowed, and the sound the trees and the birds and the river will hear is the sound of her voice saying, thank you. Epilogue. To date, 300 miles of road have been obliterated in the South Fork of the Salmon River. 200 more are scheduled for obliteration, though it is too soon to tell the effect these actions will have on the streams, tributaries, and fishes below. We can look to old data from the hundreds of miles of decommissioned roads on the Payette National Forest, the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest, and others, and know that the work is not in vain. It's important to note, too, that healing the land, at least in the South Fork, was not unlike healing a body. Groups once at odds, both federal and local, tribal and non, came together to heal a landscape, to remove a road, to support a river, to save her fishes. There are a lot of words for this kind of action, from collaboration to community, but whatever you call it, know that names are mutable, as are definitions of words, like love, but maybe more like the definition of hope. We are, as humans, capable of a great many things. The wounds men make in the earth do not quickly heal, writes Stegner. Still, they are only wounds. They are absolutely mortal. Better a wounded wilderness than none at all. Lace your fingers together one more time for another look at the South Fork of the Salmon River. Perhaps you can see it a little more clearly now. The drainages between your fingers, the steepness of the ridges. Imagine it as it can be in 5 years, in 50 years and see the river as it flows between your fingers, where the round of your knuckles meet, the river that has been carving the canyon of the South Fork of the Salmon River for millions of years. Its stories begin in the rock and soil buried beneath the mussel beds and rainstorms, cobble and thyme. You can see it, or start to, if you roll your palms upward. Look how they form something like a basin. Look at how they seem to be giving something away. Look at the life that runs in the lines. It's there. There is the answer. The one I told you was in the bottom of the river beneath the bridge that pauses like a comma. There is what it takes to make a new story. There is where the future of the South Fork, the salmon that is all fish, the West and the future for our predecessors live. There's the geography of hope. Right there, in your hands.
You just heard some clips from Eric Ian Walker's Climate Music and excerpts from C. Marie Furman reading last year at Washington State University. You can find her whole talk on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can find audio for the show and all its segments, along with additional information and links. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host for this Earth Day episode, kicking off KBOO's spring membership drive, focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and the alternative. Please join us in providing alternatives and trying to become good ancestors. You can help us reach our fundraising goal of $60,000 by becoming a member of KBOO. Less than 10% of our listeners are members, but 80% of our funding comes from members like you. So please, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or click on the red donate box in the mobile app or snail mail your paper check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks to all the contributors to today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to Kevin Foster and Zia LaBeouf for their conversation about organizing with Jewish Voice for Peace Portland. Thanks to Sophie Smith and Karen Coulter of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project for their talk about forests and how to defend them. Thanks to C. Marie Furman for her talk about the life of the Salmon River watershed. Thanks to Joe Clement for our theme song and to Desiree Helligers for behind-the-scenes help. Thanks to all the staff, volunteers, and listener members of KBOO. The Old Mole will be back next Monday with more news, views, reviews, and interviews.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Here at KBOO, today we are celebrating Earth Day. By taking a moment to celebrate nature and by bringing you special programming all day, featuring interviews with activists and nonprofit leaders.